Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the Performance People Podcast with me, Georgie.
And me, Ben. This pod is all about people who know about performance.
We're going to speak to some of the biggest performers in sport, entertainment, business and politics about how they got there and how they stay there.
And we'll talk to those closest to them about all the stuff we didn't already know about them.
You can listen to Performance People in the usual places where you get your podcasts or watch us on YouTube. And don't forget, you can always follow us on our Performance People channels.
For now, though, here's our latest episode.
Joining us on today's Performance People are two individuals who have conquered the world of track and field.
Michael Johnson dominated the 2 and 400 metres for nearly a decade, taking 4 Olympic and 8 World Championship golds. Since retiring from the track, Michael has gone on to become a much admired broadcaster and an entrepreneur in performance management.
Alongside Michael is his coach, mentor and friend, Clyde Hart, who's guided 9 American athletes to an incredible 13 Olympic golds in a career spanning more than 50 years. He's known to his disciples simply as Coach.
These two legends to the track are performance people to the core.
A lot of physical therapy, you spend a lot of time looking at yourself in the mirror, look for symmetry. But what you can also see some days, what I would see is a person who is a shell of what I used to be. You know, I would avoid being vulnerable at all costs. I would avoid being dependent on anyone else. I always wanted to not have to be dependent on other people and be the one that everyone else could depend on.
Michael, it was like winning the lottery. I did not know it at the time that I had the winning ticket.
I always said, when we win together. And when we lose, it's coach's fault. And I stand by that.
Michael, I've got something in common with you. It's called food poisoning. Last night, I found myself very, very ill ahead of today and thought, oh my goodness gracious me, how are we going to do this? And then I thought, well, goodness me, you had to go to an Olympic Games and got food poisoning there. So I'm not saying this is anything like comparable to that situation. I just want you to bear with me over the course of the next hour or so. But then I got to thinking today, what was that like having prepared all those years to take yourself to an Olympic Games and then to be in that situation where you couldn't do the job you came to do? What did that feel like? Because I feel pretty lousy today, but I've not got to try and win a gold medal. I mean, what did that feel like for you back then in 92?
Yeah, it was pretty devastating, and the competition didn't have any mercy on me. So I'm not going to have any mercy on you. You got to rally and just got to go with it today. I mean, it is what it is. You know, you got to go. No, it was devastating. I mean, that is still to this day the biggest disappointment of my career, and probably one of the biggest disappointments of my life. Because you know, as an Olympic athlete, if you are lucky and fortunate enough to make an Olympics, to get there, you know that you may never get there again. Because with all due respect to And typically when someone says with all due respect, they're about to disrespect something. With all disrespect, with all due respect to other sports, you know, most sports, it's the championship, you know, if you don't make it this year or something happens, it's, hey, we'll try again next year. With the Olympics, there is no next year, 4 years. So you may not get back there. So it was devastating, worrying. I was angry. I was all sorts of things. But fortunately, it all worked out eventually.
It did. Coach, what about from your perspective, Coach? Because, I mean, you've been in there in the thick of it with Michael all that time, prepping, getting ready, gearing up for the big moment, making sure he peaks at the right time. I mean, how did that resonate with you?
We made mistakes there. Mike made a mistake by eating some bad chicken over in Spain. And I made some mistakes in his training once we got to Barcelona, because I didn't really realize to the extent that Michael had lost so much weight, and the weight that he had lost, about 10 pounds, that wasn't fat. That's muscle when you're in shape that Michael was in. And we took some long walks from his hotel up to a long hill to the track. I'm sure that killed his legs off some. So there were some things that we both learned from 92. Though we were disappointed, he got a gold medal, but it wasn't the one that he wanted. It wasn't the one that I wanted, but he did persevere and run in the relay, which was hard for him to do because the disappointment was overwhelming in 92 because he should have won the 200 there. So it all paid off in 96. The things that we missed in 88, things we missed in 92, it all came back in good shape in 96 because when you've had 8 years of being mad, you don't want to take much mercy on your opponents, and Michael certainly didn't.
Yeah, let's live for a minute in 96 because it's the most phenomenal achievement. So let's just sort of soak it all up and relive that moment because it really was fantastic. How much pressure, though, Michael, was there on you? Bearing in mind what Coach has just said from what happened in the last 8 years leading up to that moment, how much pressure did you go to that Olympics with on your shoulders, and no least the fact you were wearing a pair of gold shoes?
I mean, obviously it was a tremendous amount of pressure going into that Olympics, having, you know, appealed to the Olympic Committee to change the schedule to even allow me to attempt the historic double. I mean, that was something that typically wasn't done. So before I appealed to them, the schedule wouldn't even allow it. And in my initial appeal, they denied it and said, no, the schedule is the schedule and we're not changing it. Ultimately, I was able to convince them to change it. They did. And so, of course, when the Olympic schedule is changed for you, then, of course, there's a tremendous amount of pressure. It's a home Olympics for me, so that's even more pressure. The past, and I mean, a lot of people said, look, why would you even attempt this? Because when you attempt to double in the 200 meters and 400 meters, and all of your competition is only running one of those races, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage, of course. So having, you know, lost the gold medal in the 200 meters and 92 4 years earlier, as Coach said, having had this disappointment for 8 years, you know, typically you would take the safe option and just, you know, run the one event. But it just wasn't, it's not who I am. It's not how I'm built. And then when it comes to the pressure, you know, I had learned by that time, I was 6 years into my professional career, that I'd learned that, you know, I produce my best performances when I'm under pressure. I've never been afraid of pressure. I guess I'm kind of one of those weird people that I like the pressure. You know, I do, you know, it's people will ask me now, you know, post my athletic career, what do you miss most? And I miss that moment just before the competition when the nerves are, you know, at their height and, you know, you're in that call room with everyone else and, you know, and only one of us is going to be the winner and all eight of us want to be, but only one can, and you're the favorite. And you know, if you win, you know, it's going to be great. But if you lose, it's going to make, you know, news around the world. And everybody's going to, you know, be talking about it the next day. I miss that moment. I loved being the favorite, you know. And so, yeah, it was a tremendous amount of pressure. But I think that's, I knew myself. And that's why produced such great performances in that championship because of the amount of pressure I was under.
Coach, did you ever try and persuade him out of doing both?
I actually, in a nice way, in a meeting with Michael, when he told me that's what he wanted to do, I really tried to convince him. I said, Michael, you got to realize you've got a relay goal. You don't have an individual goal. And you can get an individual goal in either one, but it's going to be difficult to get both. So you're gambling. And Michael says, Coach, I'm only going to get one opportunity to do this. The Olympics are in this country. I want to do something that's different. And that's just the way Michael is made up. And just like he said, he likes the pressure a lot more than I like pressure. I going back to 96 Olympics, when Michael finally won the 200, Michael went to the interview with the press, of course, and I finally got down to that area and got back in the back part of the room, and I believe it was a reporter from Japan approached me and asked me how I felt that it was all over. And I hadn't even thought really about it. And my first thought was, you know, I told him, I said, it's kind of like Columbus getting off the ship. He didn't care if he got to America or if it's Spain. He just went off that damn ship. And that's the way I felt. I'm just glad it was over after the chase that we had done to do this. It was just a big relief that it was finally over and the rewards were there. And Michael certainly had proved to the world that he could do this. And in this country, maybe in Great Britain, y'all don't know this, but one of the legends in our country was Babe Ruth pointing to knock a home run for Johnny lying sick in the hospital. Whether that ever happened or not, I don't know, but it's a good story. Well, Michael did the same thing. We call that a call shot. He was telling people, I'm going to do this, and it's going to be special. Not only was he going to win both of them, but it was going to be special. And it was. He set the Olympic record in the four and came back and set the world record in the two. And one thing about that, because you may not ask this question, but I want to get it straight. Recently, Michael's American record, which was previously the world record in the 200, was broken. And it was a great feat by the young man that did it. But you got to realize he did that on his third race. Michael did it on his eighth race in 8 days.
You might only get one shot, if at all, to race at the Olympics. Yeah. And if you want to try and guarantee getting a gold medal, you've really got to aim for this standard that even if you're having a bad day, something goes wrong, it's not quite your peak ultimate performance, you can still be in with a shout of winning. And was that the similar approach for both of you? And then that sort of led into, well, actually, could have a crack at the 200 and 400 meters because your level of performance is so strong?
Well, yeah, and so we did a test run. I say we. That's the way Michael and I always approached it, although he was doing all the work and I was there with him. But in Gothenburg in 95, that's where Michael really convinced everybody it could be done. Though we ran two less races in Gothenburg at the World Championships, Michael did the double and won at the World Championship, both the four and the two, which showed it was definitely a possibility that he could do it in the Olympic Games. It wasn't a sure thing by any means, but it was an opportunity, and Michael took advantage of it. And I think television and the Olympics and everybody got back rewarded for Michael being able to do that, because I know those TV sets stayed on in the set. They wanted to see this. And again, I don't know if it'll ever happen again.
That 200, Michael, being voted like one of the greatest track and field moments of all time. I want you to sort of really break it down for us, if you will, you know, because I think people at home don't necessarily know what normal looks like for an athlete like you performing on a stage like that. So what did you do the night before? Did you sleep well the night before? You know, what did the morning look like of the big race? How did you eat? Who did you speak to? What did you do? What processes did you go through to take yourself to that moment where it was the big moment?
It didn't have Spanish chicken, that's for
sure.
Yeah,
so
Michael, please tell them about the barbecue.
Yeah. Coach, that's just between us. one of the things that that we knew was going to be unique about Atlanta is that at that point, every championship had been in another country. We had traveled to another country in Europe or Asia for the championships or the Olympics. And now we're going to be at basically a home games. And that's going to be foreign to us because we're used to going somewhere else. we wanted to duplicate the same sort of situation that we were familiar with. So we created a foreign situation for ourselves. And we knew where the risks were, you know, of being at home. So as an example, you know, I certainly wasn't going to miss the opening ceremonies of a home Olympics. So I went there, but I wasn't going to stay in that environment either, because it was going to be too uncomfortable with me, for me, too familiar, you know, too many people that I know around. So I actually flew into Atlanta for the opening ceremonies, and then I wasn't competing for another week after that. So I flew back home and back to, you know, my training situation where coach was, and where we could control everything and we could have everything that we needed, and then flew back. In terms of what I did the night before, same thing I always did, you know, just me, my team, we have our own place, we have our own space. And, you know, everybody knows that, you know, the night before, you know, after dinner, after that time, it's shut off for me until we leave the hotel the next day at whatever time we've established to go out to the track. From that point, don't bother me, don't mess with me. I'm going to be in my room. I'm going to be going through, you know, the things that I do, which is typically, you know, sort of just visualizing the race and strategizing. But I think that, you know, it was a different situation as well for us when we got to the track, because that day, you know, for the first time, we had a semifinal and a final on the same day, which is typically not the situation. And probably, you know, and coach sometimes gets the credit for this, but probably doesn't get enough credit for making the decisions that he did on that day in terms of, you know, what we're going to do in between those two races, because it was only about 2 hours in between the two races, not enough time to actually go back to the hotel and then come back and start over, and too much time to actually just kind of live off your, you know, your initial warm-up, you know. So what do you do? And coach made the decision that we're going to go back to the warm-up track. And we were the only ones of all of the eight finalists. Everybody else stayed over. And the officials recommended that you stay there in the stadium. And we said, no, we're going to go back. We went back to the warm-up track and kind of cooled down and did a modified warm-up that coach put together. And that turned out to be the right decision, obviously, because, yeah, broke the world record and won the race.
Wow. And the start, middle, and end of that race. Can you take us through that? Can you take us through what runs through your mind as you step out onto track and you've got your gold shoes on and there's a ton of pressure, ton of expectation, home games? What did that whole breakdown of events feel like that led eventually to the gold?
Yeah,
I say so eventually, it only took you under 20 seconds.
You know, as coach alluded to before, you know, this was the eighth race in 8 days. I had already won the 400 meters. But if I didn't win the 200 meters, it wasn't going, nothing else was going to matter. That, you know, I mean, you have to complete the double, and this is the final race. And so at that point, you know, I'm so focused on delivering the performance. And my semifinal race was just absolutely stunning, even to me. You know, I mean, just the way I ran that race, I just knew I'm going to come out here and do something special. There's no way I'm going to lose this race. And it's going to be another world record. I had broken the world record a month earlier at our Olympic trials on that same track. That record had stood for 17 years, I believe. And I broke it. And then, but I knew that I was going to break it again. I knew I was going to have to beat the competition. So when the final, you know, when the gun went off, it was all about just, you know, I knew how fast I felt like I could run. I felt like I could run under 19 seconds. And no one has done that yet, but I felt like I could. And so I was focused from the beginning when the gun went off on running the fastest race I possibly could. So it was all about execution. So when the gun went off, I got a great start, but a little bit too great. And so I actually stumbled on the second, third step out of the blocks. I stumbled. I was able to recover from that, put that behind me, and continue to just run and execute. Halfway through the race, I knew that I was on track for exactly what I needed to do. I knew I was going to win the race at that point. Then it's about the record and how far can I take this record down. And and you know, after you come off the bend, you know, with 100 meters to go or 90 or so meters to go on that track, that it's all about just technique and form at this point. As a 400 meter runner as well, coming down to the 200 meters, I know that I have the speed endurance to run this all the way through the tape without any real degradation of speed or minimal degradation of speed. So it's all about just technique and form at that point, which I was able to hold. And then about just slightly less than 5 meters from the finish line, I strained my hamstring.
That's why
in that Olympics, I won the 200 and 400. I was supposed to be on the 4x400 meter relay where I would have gotten another gold medal, but I wasn't able to run it because of the hamstring.
Yeah, that's incredible. Well, thankfully it went then and not, you know, 30 meters earlier on. It would have been crawling through there. But it was, I've read, you know, lots about your performances, and you talk about that start and that race being, like you said, almost too good. But then also your ability, one of your strengths is being able to adapt through your career and through your performances to something like that. Just talk about how you do that.
Yeah, I think it's going into any race knowing that the unexpected might happen and being ready to make adjustments in real time, which is sort of the art of sprinting. Is being able to make the adjustments in real time based on what is happening, whether it's your own performances or what's going on around you with competitors, and making those decisions in real time and having the ability to do that, as opposed to going into the race. We certainly go into the race. I go into every race with a strategy that that coach and I have worked on. And this is how we're going to run this race. This is how we're going to execute. But, you know, best laid plans, you know, are great, but when something happens, if you don't have the ability to make the adjustments, then, you know, you're probably going to suffer, your performance is going to suffer from that, because I've never run a race where everything, my own performance and execution, as well as, you know, what my expectation is of the competitors, where everything went exactly like I visualized it in my head. And that is why also, even with visualization, I'm usually visualizing different scenarios and in terms of how the race is going to unfold and what I'm going to do about them. But, you know, that was a situation where, you know, I got a great start. I typically didn't get very good. I wasn't a great starter, but that day I got a great start, and my reaction, you know, I wasn't quite ready for it. So what happens is then you start to get over-rotated forward. And at that point, then you've got to sort of get back up. That happened, and, you know, you don't panic. You make the adjustment, and, you know, typically as you're executing the race, there are some things that may not go right. And when those don't go exactly as you plan, you have to then put those things behind you and then move on to the next phase of the race. And then also at the same time, you know, make decisions in terms of whether or not you make any adjustments based on what just happened. So, you know, those are the things that happen in 19 seconds. I mean, I know what it looks like, you know, gun goes off and everybody runs and fast as they can, keep turning left, and, you know, the first person to the finish line wins. And it is that simple to the naked eye. The sprinting is not quite that simple. There are a lot of things happening even in 19 seconds. And if you're really good at it, you're able to make those adjustments.
Coach, it seems crazy to think now, and you'll have to clear this up for me because I want it confirmed from you. But is it true, or is it not the case that Michael was not your first pick as a high school recruit back at college? Is that the case?
Whoa.
Well, now, you didn't have to bring this up.
Oh, yes, she did. No, she did have to bring this up. I want to hear this, Coach.
Yes, that's true. But it shows what a great recruiter I am, because I went after the guy that ended up being the world junior champion in the 200 that beat Michael at the state meet in Texas. And he was a U.S. Junior champion, went on to win the world championship. And yes, he did have committed to us, which is a bad term we use in the States. Until you sign them to a scholarship, it means nothing. So he had told me he was going to sign, and things happened out of my control that I won't get into, but I didn't get him. And on the way back from South Texas to Waco, I got to thinking, man, I need a leg on my 4x1 and 4x4 relay. I was short of one person. And I got to thinking, now who ran second? And I go back to Waco, and my assistant coach, Coach McMasters, said, yeah, it's a kid from Skyline High School. We looked it up, Michael Johnson. And we said, well, let's check it out. So I made a phone call, got an appointment to meet at his high school. And immediately getting to the high school, I felt good because the principal met me, and he could not say more great things about an individual. And before I could get to Michael, the counselor's office was the next place, and they had all these great things to say. Well, that's fine, but I got to know if the kid can really run at the level. And then that went from a home visit, and that sold me immediately because it's a plus if you get the home environment along with the academics and the athletic. And Michael's parents, Ruby and Paul, all the children had graduated from college, four sisters and a brother, and all graduated from college. So they knew the value of education. It was like winning the lottery. I did not know it at the time that I had the winning ticket, because he just filled out all the blanks and knew that he could help us immediately. Well, after his first indoor race, I knew that he was going to do more than just be a leg on both relays. He ran 43 legs on the 4x4 as a freshman. And just did some amazing things. So it just got better and better. And it just happened that I got awful lucky that he was sometimes the number two's not all that bad. We joke about that, but it was one of those things that I guess you'd have to say it was just meant to be. Think about Michael. It's been true with most of the kids that have been successful. You're going to find that is that they are dead. Michael never, now this is true, over the almost 15 years that we worked together, Michael never really challenged me, at least to my face he did, on what we were doing. But as the years went by, we would almost read each other's mind. He knew what we needed to be doing. I knew what he needed to be doing. But he never said, well, Coach, I don't think we ought to be doing that today. We need to be doing this. He didn't do that. He wasn't brought up that way. To this day, I use what he told me. We had a meeting each year on setting goals. And Michael, I said, Michael, here's a piece of paper and a pencil. I want you to write me down your goals for the year. And he sat there and he didn't do anything. I said, well, you understand what I want. He said, yes, but what about the rest? I said, what do you mean about the rest? He said, well, don't I need to put it down how I'm going to reach those goals? And I said, yeah, that would be a good idea. He had gotten that from his daddy. His daddy had put him at the kitchen table for the start of each school year and asked Michael, what are your goals in school? Not only I want to make A's or B's, but how are you going to do that? And so that changed my philosophy on asking kids what their goals. You need to go beyond that. It's good to say, I want to run this or that. But if you don't have the goal on how to do it, it doesn't mean anything.
So did you got to the point when you were at Olympic level, you really didn't have to say that much to one another. You were that close. You could read, like you say, read each other's minds, and unless something out of the ordinary was happening.
Well, let me tell you how naive Michael was about running. I mean, he knew that the track and field was going to be hard. It's competitive. But the first outdoor meet, or first or second early on, we ran a meet at Texas A&M, and they had some open runners in the 200. And Michael finished second. But in finishing second, he broke our school record. When, like, I want to say it was 20.40, I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But he was second. And Michael wasn't too happy about it. And I'm telling him, Michael, you just broke the school record. Yeah, but I got beat. I said, well, do you know who beat you? And he said, no. And I'm sitting here and I can't remember. But he was number one in the world, Michael. He'd run at Texas A&M, and they'd let him run in there. And he had beat Michael. And I said, Michael, that guy is ranked number one in the world in the 200. He said, what do you mean ranked number one in the world? So I got to explain to him, well, they rank the athletes. Why? Well, because they're going to run all over the world one day, and they got to have the rankings to get in. And that just kind of put a little ideas in mind. You mean I can go places and I can be this, and maybe there's a professional career? But he just really didn't know a lot about the atmosphere, track and field.
Now, Ben, I think, we knew each other very well. We had a great coach-athlete relationship. I think, it started with, coach, sort of teaching me you know, why we're doing the things we're doing. Because I was very inquisitive about the workouts, why we're doing the things that we're doing. And I realized, you know, the better I understand what the objective of the training is, the better I understand the objective of this workout, the better I'm going to be able to execute it. And the coach was always teaching me, and I would come to practice, and it got to a point where, you know, he would test me, what do you think we're going to do today? You know, and I would say, I think today you're going to have us doing this or that. And if I was wrong, he would explain to me, nope, that we're not doing that because we're going to do this. And this is the reason why. And so eventually, you know, I was able to understand, you know, kind of coach's philosophy, which I agreed with, you know, and it worked out really well. I could give also, I think coach understood that the better I understand this, the better feedback I can give him and the better he can coach me, because he can't he can't feel what I'm feeling, you know, on the track during the training session. So if I can provide the right feedback to him, the better he can coach me. So it was a great relationship from that standpoint. You know, I was fortunate to have a coach who challenged himself every day to be the best coach, you know, for himself, be the best coach for his athletes. And coached me hard because I wanted to be coached hard. I wanted to be pushed. I wanted to be challenged. But if I was pushed and challenged with, you know, for crap, I'm gone. I'm going to go to somebody. You know, you can't just push me and coach me hard, you know, not knowing what you're doing. You know, and coach was always learning, always challenging himself, always asking me, you know, for feedback, which was important. So it was a great relationship from that standpoint. And, yeah, you know, I mean, the things that, you know, we needed to do together, we understood that. Coach understood me as an athlete, and that I wasn't like every other athlete that he coached, and that I needed something different. And I think that was critical as well. And one of the best examples of that was when I was in college, I had a lot of injuries. So coach talked about that first year, you know, as a collegiate athlete in university and, you know, finishing second in that race and breaking school records. I showed a tremendous amount of potential that first year.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Next few years, you know, not really fully realizing that potential because of injuries. And I hated stretching and I hated strength training. I hated lifting weights. Didn't like it. I loved running. I would show up at the track ready to run, no problem. Whatever coach had for the workout that day, I'm ready to do it. I'll do more. But I didn't like stretching, didn't like strength training. And so, you know, before my final year at university, I was, you know, I knew that if I don't get through this last year injury free and finally realize this potential, I'm not going to have this professional and Olympic career that I want. So I went to coach's office before the season started and said, coach, you know, what can we do? And this was probably some of the best coaching I've ever heard of. Coach said, Michael, you know, I believe in your career. You know, I believe in you and I believe in your potential. I'll do anything I can do. So let me think about it. Think about what I can do. You know, and you think about it as well. And let's meet again in a couple of days and see what we come up with, see if we can't figure this out. I said, okay. And then just before I left, he said, hey, Michael, and let's think about also anything that maybe we haven't been doing that we can do. I said, okay. I didn't get back to my apartment before I realized exactly what he was talking about. Coach had been trying to get me to stretch and lift weights and give the same commitment to those things that I had been giving to running for 3 years. And I had been, I just didn't like doing it. It was some of the fundamental things that you have to do. And coach realized, you know, Michael's probably one of those people who he needs to come to his own conclusion, because me telling him to do something he doesn't want to do ain't working. Coach realized that, yeah, you need to learn these lessons a different way, you know, and that was critical to my relationship with coach, and, you know, understanding that, you know, he understood who I am and how I need to be communicated with. And I'm not the kind of athlete where you're going to be able to just bark instructions at me, you know, as well. And so, yeah, it's been a great relationship. And I always said, you know, that, you know, when we win together. And when we lose, it's coach's fault. And I stand by that.
Yeah.
The other thing that really comes out really clearly is this consistency piece as well. To be able to put performances together in consecutive games. And I always think this actually with regard to Ben, to be able to go back again to the games repeatedly and still put in those performances and know when to peak at the right time and how to make that happen. And that sort of that application of skill and talent and the mental strength it takes. I mean, how much of this is about mental toughness and mental strength, Michael, as opposed to just physical application and talent?
At that level, everybody is physically talented. And despite what a lot of people say, what you hear a lot of athletes saying now about, you know, working hard, you know, working hard now at the professional sport level is not a difference maker. Mm-hmm. It's about the small things, like coach said, and it's about understanding yourself as a person, as an athlete, and how do you get the best from yourself, discovering that at some point in your career. And then once you understand that, then being consistent with all of those fundamentals, being consistent with those things that help you to deliver your best performances, being consistent with those things. You know, coach and I, if you look back at our training at the beginning of my career, what I was doing then and what I was doing at the end of my career, it's very, very similar. It didn't change much. We pushed the envelope. We changed things, you know, to push and, you know, and push harder and to, you know, squeeze out a little bit more speed here, a little bit more strength there. But what was working worked, and we stayed with that. You know, I mean, coach was always looking for little things that we could change. And hey, you think we can do this? You think we can push this a little bit? You know, squeeze this rest down a little bit, you know, and reduce the rest factor here, or we can add another rep. But the structure of the training from start to finish didn't change, because that consistency is what breeds consistency at the championships. So yeah, it's very important to be consistent with the training. It's very important to be consistent mentally and understand, you know, okay, what sort of atmosphere do I need? What sort of setup do I need? What sort of process do, you know, is best for me? You know, and also understanding the sort of things that I, you know, we started this conversation talking about. You know, I already knew and understood that, yeah, I perform well under pressure, because I learned how to manage pressure. And I learned early on that, you know, you're not going to be able to make it go away. It's uncomfortable. There's no doubt about that. I'm not going to say that it wasn't uncomfortable. It was very uncomfortable, but yeah, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being in that uncomfortable situation, because I felt like I could deliver in that situation.
Did you get nervous? Did you feel nervous?
You know that. Absolutely. That's the thing that I miss, is that nervousness. Because there was one race in my entire career that I can remember where I did not feel nervous and I lost. Every other race I felt nervous. I liked being nervous. I knew that those nerves, you know, that meant, you know, I'm ready to go. But, you know, I knew what the nerves meant. You know, I'm nervous because I want this. I care about this result. I want to win. If I didn't care, then there would be no nerves, right? I was nervous because I cared about the result. I wanted to win. But I was able to control the nerves, because I knew that my chances are damn good at winning this, because I'm faster than everyone else, and I'm absolutely prepared, and I know what it takes for me to win, and I know how to go out here and execute. So when the gun goes off, that's what's going to happen. I'm going to execute the race in the way that I know how, and I know that I'm ready, so I'm probably going to win. But there's always that chance, you know, that you may not. And that's where the nerves come from. And that's the thing that I miss. Yeah.
Coach, how about you? Did you feel the nerves watching Michael? What's it like as a coach watching your athlete in a situation like that?
Yeah, after the Atlanta, I got nervous there, certainly. But when Michael, I get it the second time, another call shot, Seville, world record. Michael comes to me, says, Coach, I'm getting up there. I'm getting to be an old man, and I don't know how much. No, he didn't really say that, but he said, Coach, I need to go ahead and get the world record in the 400 because he wasn't really ever shooting for the world record in 400. He just ran to win or how he felt. Sometimes it was a double, sometimes it wasn't. So he put out the word, I'm going to set the world record. I'm going to do it at the World Championships. I'm not going to wait to 2000 because you don't want to try to set a world record at the Olympic Games because your goal there is to win. So I want to get it out of the way. So I'm going to do it at Seville. I'm going to do it in the finals of the 400. Well, that's good if you're just telling me, but now the word's out. I never will forget the semifinals at Seville in the 400. If anyone was ever going to run 42 seconds, Michael had it that day, and he knows it. His 200 split was perfect. His 300 split was perfect. And he slowed down at least three times in the final straightaway, looking back, still ran 43. And I'm sitting in the stands with Dan Patrick, Sports Illustrated, because the word was out. He wanted to be there for this world record. So it was just the two of us sitting there, and I'm looking at my watch. I said, oh, my God, he's on pace to go under 43. Well, then he slows down because he wants to do it in the finals. We got a day off between then and the finals. So I say, Michael, now I'm an old man too. Now I got to sweat another day and you're going out there. Why didn't you go, Coach? I want to get it in the finals. That's well enough. But Michael and his wife, the next day, my wife was there and we take a tour and we go to a tower there in Seville that you have a million steps going up. It's just kind of like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but it's not leaning. It's tall. We finally make it to the top. Michael's at the top of that. I said, oh, my gosh, why even worry about it? I mean, he's not worried about it. And he wasn't. And they worked out the next day when he sets the world record and the longest, the biggest margin of victory ever in a world championship in the 400. And no one else even broke 44. Had no competition.
This is it's fascinating, isn't it? Because coaching at that level, I think, is as much about what you don't say as what you do say, isn't it? Michael, you talk about it in that final in 96. All a coach said to you was just go get him, or worse to that effect. And that's all you needed to know. He didn't need to tell you anything else.
On the day when it's time to go out there, you know, and execute, you know, I always sort of felt bad for coach because now you just got to go sit in the stands because we were a team, you know, but now you got to just go sit in the stands and hope that it all works out, you know, and you have no control. And that's why I've never been able to be I couldn't imagine being a coach like that, where, you know, you're working with this athlete. And then in the moment of truth, you go sit there and just hope that it all works out. You know, I'm a control freak. So that would bother me, but I'm in control because I'm down on the track. But on the day, you know, when it's time to go out there and execute, all of the work's been done. You know, I mean, at that point, it's just a matter of, you know, just going out there and executing the race strategy and making the right decisions, which I always had the confidence that I could do.
Michael, you mentioned the fact that you're a control freak. How on earth did you deal with this stroke that you had in August 2018? Somebody who has obviously physically conditioned themselves in a particular way, and then suddenly something happens to you which is completely beyond your control. I mean, how did that sort of manifest itself with you, and what was your approach in getting yourself back to where you needed to be?
I recognize that, you know, I had a huge advantage after having had a stroke, having been an athlete, because that recovery and trying to get back to where, you know, I was before the stroke, trying to get back, you know, my strength, trying to learn to walk again and be able to run again and to cycle again and do all of the things that I was doing before, certainly is a very important goal for me. But, you know, that whole process of understanding, okay, now how do you actually achieve this goal? I know what I want, but how do you get there? You know, what sort of, you know, commitment is it going to take? And I was used to that. You know, I recognized very early in the recovery process that this is familiar territory to me. You know, when, you know, you have to be able to recognize the tiniest bits of improvement to keep you going. When you have to, you know, deal with, you know, going through an entire day of training, really rigorous training, and feeling like you got worse, but still being able to then come back the next day, you know, for more punishment and believe that it's going to get better. That's what I dealt with as an athlete. And that's certainly what I was dealing with as a stroke victim and trying to recover. And so it was very familiar to me. And that's what allowed me to be able to, you know, make that recovery. And then, you know, being me, you know, of course, I felt like, okay, I'm going to recover, and I'm going to do it, you know, faster than anyone else has. And I did, you know, I was like, you know, in 2 months after this, once I got into my recovery, 2 months, I'm going to be running again. And I was, when at that time I couldn't even walk. I was running very poorly, but I was running. But it was because of having been an athlete and those sort of things that you learn as an athlete, the skills you pick up that allow you to be your best, which, and this was certainly going to take the best of me to get back to where I had been. Those were things that I learned being an Olympic athlete. I learned a very valuable lesson.
That's an interesting point you make. How comfortable were you with feeling vulnerable?
Oh, not at all. Prior to my stroke, I was, you know, I would avoid being vulnerable at all costs. I would avoid being dependent on anyone else. You know, I always wanted to not have to be dependent on other people and be the one that everyone else could depend on. And so it was a very, strange situation, you know, to be in where I needed to be dependent on others. And it was, you know, because of my wife, you know, that I was able to, you know, sort of open up and be vulnerable and be comfortable with that. And then it was a great lesson to learn. And so since then, now I'm always like, you know, hey, I'm going to depend on everybody else. You do that. you can take that trash out. I don't need to do that.
What was it like with the, I remember reading that you'd spoken about the one of the first physio sessions you had, I think you had to complete a 200 meter, ironically, a 200 meter walk. What was that like doing that very, very differently to how you'd usually taken on a 200 meter challenge?
Yeah, it was depending on how you want to look at it. It was a very, well, in the end, it was a very enlightening sort of situation. It could have been very cruel as well. It could have been seen that way, because what happened was the first day that I was allowed to get out of bed and start to try to walk. And so you have to understand that. So when I had the stroke, it was deep in the right side of my brain. And of course, your right side of your brain controls your left side. So, you know, all of the, you know, the stroke is, you know, what it does is it starts to basically affect all of the neurological signals and how they are, you know, sent to your, you know, your ankle, your leg, your knee, your thigh, and your calf, and all of these different things, and all of these different motions that we, you know, don't think about when you walk. The coordination of all of those things, the sequence of all of those things in terms of, you know, when you dorsiflex your ankle and when you, you know, push off of your toe, and the sequence and the timing of those things, because we've been doing it for as long as we can remember, you know, you don't think about those things. Well, now that, you know, those signals have now been interrupted. So you have to relearn how to actually do all of those things. You know, when people have had surgery on their ankle and they say, I had to relearn how to walk. Well, actually, you didn't, because your brain never forgot and that connection was never severed. Whereas in my case, the connection was severed. You have to regrow brain tissue and all of these things that happen. So I got up to, you know, and I have a walker, and this therapist is going to, you know, take me around the hospital floor that I was on to, you know, get started. And so we just decided to walk around. We're going to walk around this floor and kind of a circle, oval, and back to the room. And while I was doing it, he's coaching me because I'm dragging my foot. I'm not, you know, I can't, you know, he's coaching me on what to do, basically how to walk, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. And as he's coaching me and I'm listening to what he's saying and I'm trying to then duplicate those things, I can feel myself immediately. And he's, nope, you wouldn't be able to see a difference, but I can feel the difference as I'm trying. No different than what coach was teaching me and, you know, explaining to me on the track every day. Okay, Michael, you need to do this. Okay, got it. I can do that. Next rep, I'm doing that, you know. And so that's what was happening. So I could feel that improvement. And when we got back around, completed this oval and back to the room, I looked back and I thought that was probably about 200 meters. And I looked and I was like, and that took me about 10 minutes. But, you know, when I went back into the room, you know, as opposed to being discouraged, I remember saying to my wife, I'm going to make a full recovery. I can guarantee. I mean, at that point, I didn't know. They hadn't even allowed me to get up and walk. I had to spend 2 days just laying there. I didn't know if I would ever walk again or if I'd just be walking with a cane or a walker or, you know, I didn't know what level of recovery I was going to be able to make. But I said, I'm going to make a full recovery and I'm going to make it faster than anybody could possibly imagine. And she knows that I'm not, you know, the type of person to, you know, just sort of throw bullshit out there. You know, it's, you know, if I say that, there's a good reason for it. And she said, well, what happened? And I was like, this is familiar to me. I know how to gain improvement. And it helped being in very good shape. With zero, you know, from my left side, my right side is pretty good. So I can, you know, compensate pretty well. But that was that situation. And from there, you know, I got into full, you know, recovery mode, and there were good days and there were bad days. There were some difficult days. You spend a lot of time when you're in that sort of recovery, a lot of physical therapy, you spend a lot of time looking at yourself in the mirror to look for symmetry. But what you can also see some days, what I would see is a person who is a shell of what I used to be. I'm looking at myself and it's like, wow, you know, that's me right there. I can barely lift whatever, you know, and that can be very discouraging. So there are some days where, you know, mentally you have to figure, you know, out how to get yourself back up and get motivated. And there's no greater motivation than wanting to not have to be dependent on people and be a burden on people because you can't walk and wanting to get back to, you know, the sort of livelihood that I had before.
No, it's fascinating, isn't it, to hear about that and how, like you say, the Olympic mindset probably put you in a really good place to be able to cope with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, the things that you learn, and Ben, you know this, you know, just the Olympics is different. That mindset is different, again, because it's not, you know, it's not every year, you know, and especially for those sports that, you know, like our sports that aren't team sports, you know, where it's the individual and, you know, and it takes a certain mindset and that sort of mindset can work wonders for you in other parts of life as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But Coach Hart, you're in pretty good shape as well.
Yes.
I can say.
Yeah,
he never works out. He doesn't work out. Never works out. He'll tell you he doesn't work out. He never worked out. He walk around the track a lot. Now he plays golf all of the time. But he looks like he's 60 years old, and he's not.
I know. He's still going strong.
Yeah. Well, I play golf. Try to play golf twice a week. And I'm 88 going on. Got about 4 months. I'll be 89. And I shot 87 yesterday, so I feel pretty good. But now sometimes I go out and shoot 95, but we got a foursome, and sometimes I shoot well, sometimes I don't. But I enjoy it. Didn't play golf when I was coaching. I'd have been a terrible coach if I played golf because I love golf now, and I would have been out on the golf course more than what. But
Michael, I just want to clear something up. You on Ben's boat in San Francisco back, and I'm guessing it was like 2013, something, 2012, 2013, something, in preparation for the America's Cup that got held in the San Francisco Bay. There are rumors, and I need you to clarify, did you fall off the boat or did you jump off the boat? Which happened?
He definitely wasn't pushed. Let's clear that up.
I don't recall, sorry. My audio went out.
Sorry. Oh, that's very convenient. No, that's really convenient.
Ben, I think Ben had somebody push me off.
I didn't even.
It was Ben because I wasn't on Ben. I wasn't on Ben's boat, but Ben did organize this entire thing. The entire thing.
So what happened?
I ended up in the San Francisco Bay. That is true. All I know is Ben organized this entire thing, and I ended up in the San Francisco Bay.
You were supposed to be on the boat. You were supposed to be on the boat, and you ended up in the water, in shark-infested waters, which doesn't feel like it's a fair alternative to being on the raceboat, frankly.
Yeah, you were with Jimmy. You were with Jimmy, weren't
you? I was with Jimmy Spittle.
We did this race, and afterwards, our boat came up, and I said, how's Michael? Oh, no one knows where Michael is. Wait, what do you know? No one knows where Michael is. What's happened? Yeah, so I was devastated.
We were going over from one side to the other. I caught my foot and went over into the water.
But those boats are going at quite some speed. You know, they're going 40, 50 kilometers an hour or something at that in those days.
That's going to hurt.
Yeah, it hurts when you fall off of that speed. So, yeah, wow.
Yeah, I came off into the water, but I'm still here despite whatever Ben was trying to do to me.
Have you been back out in the bay since?
Yeah. Not. I've been on a boat this time because you weren't involved in it this time. I actually stayed on the boat.
Fair enough. Glad to hear it.
Also, the gold shoes, were they different sizes?
The left is a little bit smaller than the right because they weren't made on normal sizes. They're made, for my foot to fit my foot. My left foot's a little bit smaller than my right. So I have the right shoe. Coach has the left for all of my world records.
Is that the case?
I bet it's the smallest one at mine because you're going to keep the big one.
So I'd like to get a performance tip from both of you. Something that people like myself could maybe take into everyday life. So if there was going to be one performance tip from each of you, maybe Coach, you go first. What would your tip be to me for everyday life? How to perform better?
Adjust your focus. Michael Johnson, that was a trademark. Everybody thought sometimes Michael was standoffish, but Michael could get in the zone, get focused on what he needed to do. And once you get focused, then you will have the ability to establish the things you need to do to be successful. And of course, there's no easy way to do things. You can't say, well, can I do it this way because it's not as much work? No, it's not true. So I would think Michael's, to me, his tremendous ability to focus on the task at hand and then to accomplish it.
It's a good one. Michael?
Yeah, I'd say, I think the one of the things that was probably the single most impactful thing for me on my entire career as an athlete and as a person is really understanding myself as a person, understanding, what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, what are my fears, what am I, why, the whys behind all of those things, understanding myself. So the better people understand themselves, the better you're able to navigate life and life situations, not just winning gold medals, but raising kids, career, goals, understanding yourself and not being afraid to sort of admit to where you, like we talked about earlier, understanding, how my, not really wanting to depend on other people, how does that affect me in life? And how can I be better by being more comfortable being vulnerable?
Can I ask a favor?
Yes.
Can I have my wife say hello to Michael? Because she's going to kill me if she doesn't get to say hello to Michael.
That'd be lovely.
She's in her chair in the other room. She doesn't know I'm going to ask her to do this. So okay. She may turn me down.
But just give you guys a little background on this. So Coach's wife, Dr. Maxine Hart, was a professor at Baylor University for years in the business school where I went to school. So I was in the business school. I was a business major. So not only did I have Coach over here on the track every day, but luckily she was not my professor. I didn't take any of her classes, but all of her friends and fellow professors was my professor. So I had just eyes on me all the time.
Oh, that's nice.
Great. Yeah.
Hello.
This is my wife, Maxine, Dr. Hart.
Hello, Dr. Hart.
Hello.
Hello. Good to meet you.
It's good to see you. How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good.
Well, good.
How are you?
I'm doing very well. We're on a podcast here, and Coach has been very well behaved.
Just to let you know, Michael's part of our family, and we love him and miss seeing you, Michael.
Miss seeing you as well. Hopefully, yeah. I get to see you soon.
Some of my favorite memories, I think of them every now and then, that we had with you. Just great. Glad to see you.
Thank you.
Michael, they must have played a huge part in your life, though, right? I mean, my goodness. I mean, you know, you were in each other's pockets for a very long period of time.
Okay.
So it was I always say it was kind of like a relay team, to be honest. My parents did a great job. I owe a lot to them. And they were very much involved in the process when I was deciding where to go to university and I was being recruited. And they always, you know, thought that the coach was just a first class person and that he was, you know, going to take really good care of me. And so when I made the decision to go to Baylor, they were very pleased. And then we got the bonus, of having Dr. Hart as well, Coach's wife, who, again, as I said, was in the business school and that I could always rely on. And if I didn't show up in class, then, you know, one of those professors was going to tell Dr. Hart and Dr. Hart was going to tell Coach, or I was going to get a call from her saying, hey, you know, this is what I'm hearing. So,
it's lovely to see. I feel like we've just taken you on a massive trip down memory lane there, but it's really nice to be involved in it. So thank you. I just want to say thank you to both of you. That's really kind of you to spare your time. Coach Hart, you too. Thank you so much for joining
us.
And to your lovely wife. And Michael, thank you for you know, taking us on your journey and explaining to us, you know, the Olympic mindset and what it takes to have achieved what you've achieved. It's been fascinating.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, I hope so.
Just
too.
Not in the San thank Franciscan you. Bay.
So I just love that chat. I mean, for me, it was fantastic going back to sort of that coach sportsperson relationship, Olympic Games and so on. I think the honesty and respect that they have for one another really shone through. You know, Coach laying on the line for those training sessions and then Michael having to go out and execute on the day. Some wonderful insights.
I think it tells you a lot about their characters, the two of them, the fact that one of them took one shoe away and one of them took the other shoe away from every meet. It shows just sort of how they saw their relationship and their dynamic and how it was very much a team effort, despite the fact, like you say, Michael was the one executing it.
Yeah, true partnership.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for listening or watching. We are Ben and Georgie Ainsley, and this has been Performance People. And remember, from what we've learned today, learn to understand yourself a little bit better because it might help in every way.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.